everybody, and welcome to this Constitution Unit webinar on regulating public appointments. My name's Meg Russell. I'm the director of the Constitution Unit, and I'll be chairing this session this afternoon. We're absolutely delighted to be joined today by Peter Riddell, a very long-time friend of the Constitution Unit, who's nearing the end of his term as Commissioner for Public Appointments. Peter has a long and distinguished CV on constitutional matters. For decades, he was a respected journalist and broadcaster. He's been director of the Institute for Government between 2012 and 2016. He's written many excellent books, including on Parliament, and he's a former chair of the Hansard Society. The role of Commissioner of Public Appointments was established following a recommendation from the Nolan Committee in the 1990s to allay concerns about political cronyism in the public appointments process. 5 years ago, Peter's predecessor, David Normington, gave a valedictory talk at the Constitution Unit, which was highly critical of the Cameron government's handling of public appointments, and particularly of the review, the recently completed review of the public appointments process conducted by Jerry Grimstone. If you're interested in what David Normington said, you can find a summary of his talk on our blog. Today's event was due to be a follow-up as Peter completed his term. But while he was due to end in April, 10 days ago, the government announced that his term was being extended until September to allow time for his successor to be put in place. So in fact, in the Constitution Unit's 25-year history, I think this may be a first as what Peter labels a pre-valedictory talk. I hope that nonetheless, he's going to be prepared to be pretty frank. He's remained a strong and independent voice while he's held this role. For example, you can find his most recent annual review on the Commissioner's website and watch his recent evidence to the Committee on Standards in Public Life's current Standards Matter inquiry. A week ago, he published reflections on 5 years on since the Grimstone review on the Commissioner's blog. So we're very interested to hear what Peter's got to say today. This whole event, including the Q&A session, is being recorded and it will be posted online on the Constitution Unit's website, YouTube channel, and on our podcast after the event. We'll let all people attending know when the recording is available and hope you might want to share it with others. Peter will speak initially for 20 minutes or so, after which I may ask him a few questions before opening up to questions from you in the audience. If you have a question that you'd like to put to Peter, please use the Q&A function rather than the chat function. And Alan Rennick, the unit deputy director who's here on screen with us, is going to be our Q&A facilitator. So he will select a broad range of questions from what you've submitted. And we will by default ask the questioner to unmute themselves and ask their own question. But if you would prefer Alan to ask the question on your behalf, either mentioning your name or anonymously, please say that when you submit it and he will do so. So I think that's all of the administration. I'm absolutely delighted to hand over to Peter, and Peter, we're all greatly looking forward to hearing what you have to say.
Thanks very much indeed, Meg. I'm much appreciated for the introduction. I happened to walk past the physical unit, as it may be almost nostalgically called, and I regretted I wasn't sitting in your kind of basement room doing this. It was very, very, very odd. I thought, oh, if only. As you said, this is slightly unusual as what I've dubbed a pre-valedictory, because 6 weeks ago I got approached by the government to say, would I mind extending my term, since they weren't ready to announce my successor, I must have to go through a pre-appointment hearing and to allow time for a smooth handover. And I said, but only with a strict time limit, and because I very strongly believe in non-renewable terms for regulators. And so it's an extension, and it's very much limited to September, which should give time for a smooth handover on that. But it doesn't affect what I'm saying on this matter. Obviously, I'm constrained on what I can say on some other matters, but not on appointments. Although I can't talk about the current appointment issues. I couldn't have done that anyway, because they're obviously under review. Now, public appointments matter. They're one of those things in government which is important, but often not urgent. Our arms length bodies are responsible for running, regulating, or advising on massive swathes of public life, from national museums and galleries, of our prisons, charities, social mobility, human rights, to scientific research, and the NHS, which has been a particular concern in recently. My role as commissioner over the past 5 years has been to oversee appointments made by ministers to non-executive positions on the boards of more than 300 UK bodies and 55 Welsh government ones. So I'm also the commissioner to the Welsh government, which is separate from my UK role. I don't know if any devolution fans may want to explore the meaning of that, which I'm happy to do. And actually, it's an advantage because it gives me a different perspective and I have from looking at things from Cardiff. This works out between 1,800 and 2,200 appointments and reappointments a year, although it's just under 1,600 in the last reporting year, which of course included the election and all the political upheavals of 2019 to 20. I don't make appointments myself, and that's different from the Civil Service Commissioner, my friend Ian Watmore, who sits on panels for Permanent Secretary and other senior appointments. I don't do that. I'm the regulator. I hear appeals, I carry out investigations, and I oversee what happens. My priority is to ensure fair treatment for applicants and to encourage a wider range of applicants as possible. My overall experience has been positive, though with undeniable frustrations. The changes introduced following the Grimstone Review, which Meg mentioned, altered the commissioner's role from being an active participant in nominating the chairs of major appointments to being a regulator. And as David Normington, in fact, said in his lecture to the unit, changed the commissioner's role to be much more of a exercising influence more publicly. And that turned out to be a very perceptive forecast of what's happened. And David was right on that. I use the word influence. It's a real power to make appointments has always lain with ministers. Before the Grimstone Review, the commissioner's role was more overt. Since it's been more indirect, but it still existed quite strongly. Partly thanks to some important changes I negotiated between the publication of the review and its completion and introduction, replacing the commissioner code. Notably, embodying the concept of fairness in the code. That's really important because it enabled me in rulings to say, are candidates being treated equally? And that's a very important principle. And also ensuring that my office is consulted at key stages of the process. And I can see relevant papers at any stage to carry out investigations. The process has been satisfactory in the vast majority of cases for those involved, even though, and this is a really important caveat, it's taken much longer than it should do. Following the Grimstone Review, there was agreement on an aspiration, the government's always reluctant to call it a target, of 3 months between the closure of applications and the announcement. Jerry Grimstone actually suggested a slightly tighter timetable than that, or tighter definition. But as a thematic review carried out my office pointed out 2 years ago, there are big delays. This 3 month review is missed in more than half the cases, and the average is nearer 5 months. And that was 2 years ago. And we haven't done an update to take account of the election, the political upheavals, and COVID, which won't have helped. The problem about these delays is they risk alienating candidates and discouraging potential strong appointees from applying. I believe that ministers need to pay much more attention to the concerns of candidates than those appointed. Often those with private sector experience they want to attract who become rather frustrated by the experience. Overall, and this is something which gets practically no public attention, but for me as commissioner is very, very important. The handling of appointments has been improved by a new system of annual compliance and audit. This involves self-assessments by departments, which make the appointments, audit visits, which of course have been virtual. This is done in the autumn and straying over into January, and an assessment by my team, followed by contacts between me and permanent secretaries. The aim has been to create a spirit of cooperation and a culture of improvement, not a blame culture. And there's some successes judging by the latest audit. And we also have a wash-up meeting of all the appointments people around Whitehall, which is very productive when best practice is shared. And whilst this can sound a bit nerdy and administrative, it is really important for the process of people going through appointments. And I think it's been a real gain. That's been a largely unheralded achievement, almost entirely due to the efforts of my excellent two-person team. And I emphasize two-person. It's a very small team, but very good team. The other main advance has been in my role as champion of diversity. I've been active in supporting, encouraging initiatives to broaden the range of candidates applying and being appointed. In the last reporting year, the number of women appointed to the boards of public bodies was more than 50%. I keep repeating that whenever I can. It's a real achievement. And some of this goes back to the efforts of the coalition government, which boosted it up to the early 40s nearly a decade ago. However, still only a third of chairs are women, and needs to be much more progress there. Perhaps we'll discuss that later. Ethnic minorities accounted for 15%. That's more or less in line with the adult share. That's, again, an achievement. However, on disabilities, the performance is still very disappointing, at less than 7%. There are problems there of definition on disabilities, people because it's self-declaring, and but much more needs to be done there. And I've become quite involved with a number of disability champions, and there was a very good review carried out by Lord Holmes of Richmond, to which the government is committed to the objectives, but much more needs to be done to implement them. This progress on diversity is a combination of high quality candidates, and I think we are in a self-sustaining position, particularly on women, but also in relation to certain ethnic minority groups. The problem is you get an overall ethnic minority definition, when in fact much more interesting is some of the differences between various groups, and we don't really have the full data for that. But I think more needs to be done then, and that's again a victim of COVID not being able to do some initiatives there. The Cabinet Office is committed to updating its diversity action plan with a broader definition of diversity, looking also at a range of views on social and geographical diversity. And I'll mention an important point there shortly. I hope this broader definition will not undermine the long established goals, and also that seeking a range of views doesn't mean just one view. Any revised diversity and inclusion strategy also needs to consider remuneration. My office recently completed a thematic review which showed that not only that half of appointments aren't paid at all, that's notably some local justice bodies like the Independent Monitoring Board, which look at prisons and so on, but there's also a totally inconsistent relationship between time commitment and pay. The review is, which is on the web, my website, the office website, is actually very startling. On there's no rhyme or reason. What it is this is how we've done, and departments, it's very much a departmental responsibility, and there are big inconsistencies. The variations are quite startling, but offering financial support may help reduce some of the disincentives to disadvantaged groups from applying. I mean, I've talked to a number of people with caring responsibilities or portfolio jobs, particularly those, you know, much younger than me who got a retirement income, but they are present discouraged from applying. The experience of COVID has also offered a way to achieve more diversity and inclusion. Remote meetings have not only been successfully adopted across Whitehall for interviewing and appointing, and it's been a great success story, real resilience, and there was a kind of short hiatus. Exactly a year ago, but that's quickly they got back into momentum of doing it. But also remote has, of course, become the norm for what we're doing now and for the boards of public bodies. I believe that post-COVID boards should consider half and half physical and remote meetings of boards during a year, not hybrid meetings, because they distort things by giving advantage to those who are in the room. But I think the mixture could reduce the inconvenience and cost of being board members for many currently underrepresented groups, such as disabled, those with caring responsibilities, and of course those living a long way from London and other big centres. And I've been pressing this around Whitehall, and I think there's some positive response there. I wanted to stress these positive aspects of the current system, since they have tended to be overshadowed by the arguments over politicisation, a term which confuses more than it clarifies. There are two aspects to politicisation. One is who does the appointing, and second, who is appointed. The original Nolan report 26 years ago summed up the essence of the process, quotes, "Responsibility for appointments should remain with ministers advised by committees which include independent members," end quotes. It's therefore been inherently political. Appointment on merit has always been qualified by ministerial choice. Contrary to the assertions of some, there's never been a golden age where appointments were made in a non-political way, just on merit. And sometimes when people refer to this, it's merit means people they want, or vice versa. Similarly, it's never been an unconstrained system of political patronage. the process of competition, judging applications in relation to published job and personal specifications, is about competence. It does not produce a single recommended candidate. It's about presenting a list of appointable candidates to ministers for a final decision. Critics claim this is a charade, since politicians allegedly choose whom they want. This is certainly what some, but not all, ministers and special advisers would like. It's frustrating that I can't prove that this view is a gross oversimplification, but my experience has shown that the advisory interview panels do act in a robust way in judging who is appointable and who not. Allies of ministers are not always assessed as appointable. Some are on and not even interviewed, though panels have to explain to ministers why a recommended candidate is not worth interviewing. In many cases, of course, people suggested by ministers are judged appointable, but it's not automatic. Over the past 18 months, the present government has actively sought to appoint allies to the boards of public bodies. That's clear. This isn't the first time this has happened. Such attempts tend to go in waves as you get a new government coming in. And there is nothing in the governance code, or indeed in past practice, against appointing people with political links. Many former ministers have proved to be effective chairs of public bodies. It's perfectly understandable that ministers want to appoint allies and those who agree with their goals to executive arm's length bodies. And I emphasise the word executive, and I'll come on to that later on. Past Labour, as well as Conservative governments, have appointed people with clear party backgrounds and ties. What's different now is the breadth of the campaign and the close engagement of 10 Downing Street. But just as political activity should not be a bar to appointment, so it shouldn't be a qualification. We need a wide range of people and views on public body boards. And that's where I do agree with ministers. It's got to be a wide range. Pluralism rather than partisanship. The key should be whether or not someone is judged appointable. To put this in perspective, in recent years, well under 10% of appointees have declared significant political activity. Many of them members of locally based justice and health bodies. This is despite misleading headlines about high percentages of Labour or other supporters being appointed. Assertions which reflect a kind of statistical confusion based solely on the share of the very small minority declaring political links, and which ignore that the vast majority of appointees are, like the rest of the population, non-political. The advisory interview panels are central to the integrity of the process. And this is where I've been publicly expressing worries in recent months. Ministers are in a strong, even dominant position in public appointments, but some are now seeking to tilt the process even further to their advantage. First, there have been leaks that Number 10 faces certain candidates even before a competition starts. This matters mainly because it deters good candidates from putting their names forward, and there is anecdotal evidence of such a chilling effect. Ministers insist that they deplore such leaking, but it hasn't stopped some of their advisers. Second, ministers have tried to undermine the independence of interview panels. For significant appointments, that's mainly the chairs of public bodies and freestanding regulators. A senior independent panel member is chosen after consultation with me, someone who has no ties to the sponsoring department and no reported party activity. For a long period, this worked well and harmoniously. But in the past year, there have been a few cases of ministers trying to appoint such senior independent panel members, such as Conservative peers, who clearly breached the rules. Fortunately, official guidance has clarified the meaning of the code. However, there have been cases of ministers seeking to pack interview panels, most blatantly in the case of the competition for the office of the chair of the Office of Students, but also in other cases by appointing non-executive members of the departmental boards who are political allies. This could weaken the independent element. This could weaken the independent element, which the Nolan report emphasised. A further problem has been the proliferation of unregulated appointments made by ministers, as opposed to the list of regulated appointments in the Urine Council available on my website. Some appointments, for instance, in response to COVID, such as Kate Bingham's role as head of the UK Vaccine Task Force, are fully justified, and short-term reviews are rightly excluded from my remit, which is mainly focused on permanent bodies. But there is uncertainty about the number and nature of these unregulated appointments and how they are made. For instance, there's an unclear balance between direct ministerial appointment to and competition for non-executive members of departmental boards whose character has recently changed substantially, something I know the unit's looked a lot at. The question is balance. Ministers will always and rightly take the final decisions. Indeed, in some respects, there is a case for them being more publicly accountable for appointments. But some changes can and should be made to secure a better balance, and I've got seven specific suggestions to conclude with. First, senior independent panel members should have a specific duty of reporting to the Commissioner on the conduct of competitions, as some do informally. Second, the Commissioner should be consulted on the composition of all members of interview panels for all significant appointments to ensure a fair balance. Third, a limited number of regulators concerned with ethics, standards, and appointments in public life should be appointed in a more independent manner and differently from the chairs and members of bodies with executive responsibilities. That's a point I referred to earlier. On executive responsibilities, ministers reasonably have the main say since they're taking forward government policy, and I've got no quarrel on that score. Interview panels for such political and ethical regulators should have a majority of fully independent members, while the relevant Commons Committee could have a veto, as in the case of the Office for Budget Responsibility. The issue of appointment is related to the question whether the role and powers of such regulators should be enshrined in primary legislation as opposed to orders in council. And that's a very important distinction. For example, the Civil Service Commission in the what's known as the Cragg Act of 2010, just before the election then, has legal protection. My position as an appointments commissioner is set up in order in council. It's quite a hassle to do it, but it can be done much more simply than changing primary legislation. Fourth, due diligence is central to public appointments, especially as almost all roles are part-time and remunerated accordingly. Therefore, appointees are likely to have other roles and sources of income. And this is an important distinction to make in light of the controversy of the last 10 days about civil servants and a couple of the stories that confused public appointees and civil servants. Public appointees are going to be part-time and have other interests. It's actually desirable if we're going to get busy people below retirement age to serve on public bodies. If they're to be attracted, it's got to recognise they are going to have other interests. They need to be transparent at all stages, and this needs to be discussed from interview onwards. Moreover, the growth of social media has meant that tweets and the like are crawled over, and even the most casual tweet and retweet can be used in decision-making over an appointment. The key here is proportionality and relevance, keeping in mind the purpose of the body. Candidates must be given a chance to explain their public comments. That is how conflicts of interest can be managed. Quite often conflicts can be managed. However, and this is a point which I don't think is always taken into account by some people appointed. Once appointed, I think it's quite reasonable that members of boards should constrain their public comments. I mean, I understand why ministers get annoyed if someone's been appointed to a body, then turns around and criticises the government on something. Obviously, there's got to be proportionality there, but I understand that constraint. I mean, in my case, it's an absolute one. I think I'm one of the few people who's never commented on Brexit. Possibly that's a relief. The provision in the code, fifth point now, the provision in the code for ministers to be able to appoint candidates judged unappointable by an interview panel should be removed. I opposed it when it was introduced. It's not so far been invoked, and if used, would undermine the credibility of anyone appointed. Sixth point, it should become routine practice for select committees to consult the commissioner over preferred candidates for designated pre-appointment hearings in order to receive an assessment about the integrity of the competition. At present, I do this occasionally on my own initiative. Similarly, committees ought to be more willing to summon secretaries of state to explain and justify controversial selections instead of just leaving the candidate on their own. Perhaps we could explore this further. Seventh and final point, the department should publish a list of all non-regulated appointments, czars, reviewers, envoys, task force leads, as well as their regulated appointments, in order to build greater transparency about who is doing this important work on behalf of the government, as well as how they are appointed. I mean, it's quite reasonable that many appointments are unregulated, but we just don't know what they are. None of these suggestions challenges the basic principles of the government's code or the centrality of ministers in deciding whom to appoint. but these ideas might help to ensure that competitions are seen to be fair and have a strong independent element. That is central to public confidence and credibility. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions, apart from I can't discuss current competitions or personalities for obvious reasons, and I couldn't do that even though I wasn't commissioner. But I obviously can't do that. But otherwise, over to you, Meg.
Thank you very much, Peter, for that very wide-ranging talk. And there are questions coming in, and I'm sure that people will want to formulate their questions and pick you up on lots of the points that you've made and ask more. As Peter said, please try and resist asking him about specific appointments that are going on. Please try to resist asking him about the appointment of his own successor, which he can't comment on and I think doesn't have the information on, even if you wanted it. And one more thing, you might want to pull Peter into discussions about ministerial standards, which has been very much in the news recently, but is not really what we're here to talk about. And I should flag for you that our next event is going to be on ministerial standards in May. So try and hold your questions for that. But do put questions in the Q&A, and Alan is going to be going through them, and I'll invite Alan in a minute to pull out some of those questions and get a wider conversation going. But let me start just by asking a couple of things to Peter while we wait for questions to come in. Very interesting, that list of seven proposals at the end, and I'm sure that people will want to dive in and ask you about some of the specifics of some of them. But broadly, this may be an impossible question, the how and the when to achieving those things. I mean, is there any expectation that any of this could be achieved before you leave office? Can any of it be done readily? Some of it would require legislation, I think, but what would be some of the mechanisms for things we could do now?
I think some of the things, that's why I carefully phrased it within the governance code. I mean, one or two involved, let's look at the list, would involve changes to the governance code, but not significant ones. More of them are practice. I mean, the senior independent panel members having a duty to report to me, some of them already do. I have good dialogues, in fact, with a couple of current appointments, I'm talking to the senior independent panel members on them. That's just a matter of custom and practice and attitude. Being consulted on panels, that would be a tweak on it. I mean, I'm not saying a veto, but consultation and able to express a view, which I do express a view anyway, but I mean, it just make it more automatic. The regulators appointed in a more independent way would be a change. But I think that a lot can be changed informally on that by just the composition of panels. It doesn't, I mean, I ultimately lead to it, but it could be changed by having, ensuring you do have an independent, a strong independent element and a majority on that. Due diligence is custom and practice. What I'm really saying there is two things. One is on taking account of financial conflicts of interest, that's good practice and it should be happening anyway. And in the given light of controversies, I think people are well aware of that. But it's also bearing in mind people are going to have interests. I mean, I had a conversation with some commercial regulators in the economic field yesterday who were feeling very bruised by accusations they've got other interests. And they say, look, we're part-time. And so I think that there are some very live issues there which don't require any change of regulation, but a more sophisticated public debate. The unappointable one, well, it hasn't happened so far. I'd like it changed, but the key thing is it hasn't happened, and that's been very important. It hasn't happened. I think people recognised what would happen. If a minister tried to do that, the correspondence between me and the minister would be published. And I wouldn't, I think it's not exactly a great start for an appointee to have been told, to be announced publicly that they weren't judged appointable by an independent panel with strong independent members. And that's been a deterrent so far. Select committees, that's a very interesting one and very much up your street, Meg. And I think that select committees vary. Sometimes they regard pre-appointment hearings as a chore. And this is what some of the constitution research has done. I found I often had to push it and say, look, I'm willing to give you advice on the process. It's up to you, the individuals, entirely up to the committee and the ministers. But I'm willing to, and in fact, in many respects, it's the minister's interest, because I can say it's been a proper process and it's been done legitimately. And in fact, in one recent case, I think it was a positive when people were sceptical about the process. So that could be done in that way. And the publication of non-regulated could be done without any legislative change at all.
One of the recommendations you make is that certain appointments should be singled out for an even more independent process. Yeah. And I think that some of those types of appointments you have in mind are probably some of the things that would be of interest to this audience in terms of constitutional regulators and so on. Could you say a bit more about what bodies you've got in mind and maybe what process?
Well, it's very interesting that, because in making that reference and is drawing it up. I would certainly, I mean, there's some obvious ones. My own job, for example, Civil Service Commissioner, the Chair of the Committee on Standards and Public Life, Chair of the House of Lords Appointments Commission, and the Business Appointments. I mean, we're all kind of, it's a small group who work together, who are constitutional political watchdogs, who aren't, I draw a distinction here from those involved with Parliament, because there are kind of two groups. So the ministerially appointed ones, like my one, and then there's a whole group of people, I mean, like the Electoral Commission and so on, who have a link with Parliament, and very much, I mean, for example, the appointment of chair of the Electoral Commission is nothing to do with me, it's entirely a parliamentary thing. And so you've got those two parallel processes, and so I would certainly start off with that. Then you get into some much more difficult areas, for example, the Equalities and Human Rights Commission, which has aroused a lot of strong feeling, Charity Commission, and so on and so forth. So there are, I would say there needs to be a debate about that, partly because some of these people aren't just regulators, and they're not constitutional regulators, they have a much broader remit, and I can understand ministers' reservations on that. And it's clear with the constitutional ones what should happen.
I can imagine that Robert Hazell's going to want to come in the questions on some of this. There are so many things of interest to him here, but he's currently working, as you know, with Marcial Boo on a project on the constitutional regulators.
Indeed, so absolutely.
He may want to take that further.
But I think the distinction is with Parliament. I mean, there's a very, I mean, the that's where there needs to be more debate and more clarity, that that Parliament has its specific role in relation to some, and which works reasonably well. But then there's, say, the kind of ones set up under ordering council like me and some of the other constitutional ones I've mentioned.
And for anybody who thinks we're having too private a conversation here, Robert Hazell is my successor as the director of the Constitution Unit, and that's a Constitution Unit project that I referred to. It might not surprise you, Peter, that you mentioned HOLAC. And you also talked about the appointing the unappointable and how that was one of the grimstone changes, I think, wasn't it, to allow ministers to appoint from sort of below the line.
Yeah, it was insisted by my ministers. There was a debate during people look at grimstone and then the code, but actually there was 8 months in between. And there was a debate. And as I mentioned, there were various changes, which David Normanton has freely acknowledged, changed some of the, I mean, didn't fully blunt his criticisms because he wasn't happy with the Grimstone review or some of the other changes, but did have a different impact on that. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, obviously you say that that hasn't been used and there are some understandable reasons for it not to be used, but wouldn't it perhaps only take one for the culture to change? I mean, we saw this with HOLAC, the House of Lords Appointments Commission, which advises on propriety, advised against one of the Prime Minister's appointments that was made in December, and he made it anyway, and a letter was published, and that feels like maybe a dam has been breached. Do you think the same thing could happen here?
That's a very interesting question, Meg. I sincerely hope not. I mean, I recorded in my annual report that there was an attempt by a minister, which was only 4 years ago, 3.5, 4 years ago, to appoint an unappointable. Someone who'd been rejected for interview, then was interviewed, and then rejected after the interview. And I pressed strongly against it and said, look, you ought to have a fresh competition. And I wouldn't say it was done with happiness and embrace of how wise I was. It certainly wasn't. But it did result in a fresh competition and produced a very good candidate, and that was the end of the matter. And in fact, no one knows who the minister was or the appointment was, and that's the deal, that, you know, if you can persuade people privately, it's much better to do it. But if you insist upon doing it, now it's a very interesting question you raised, that if it did happen, would you then have it be the beginning of a pattern? Well I think there's many people don't want to have the embarrassment factor, because Whitehall hates embarrassment.
One could imagine this Prime Minister saying, oh, well, nobody actually cares. What they care about is the vaccine rollout, and let's all move on.
All I can say is over the 5 years, well, 4.5 years since the new code came in, it hasn't happened. And I just hope for the next 5 months.
I'm going to go over to Alan in a second, but let me ask you just one more thing, which I think fits with all of this. You've talked quite a lot. You mentioned it today, and you've mentioned it in other public appearances that you've made about pushback, the pushback that you've had to provide. And I think that probably goes with the comment that you made about David Normington and how the Grimstone changes make this a more public role, less behind the scenes. How dependent is the whole integrity of the system on the robustness of the commissioner? I mean, you are a robust person. That pushback, that's quite a hard thing to do. I think that's quite a lot to expect of someone. Do you feel it's maybe too vulnerable? I think you do. I mean, on the unappointable thing, you've suggested change, that actually some more of this should be underpinned by codified rules that don't rely on the commissioner holding the line so much.
I mean, ideally, obviously, the clearer guidance is, remembering this is very dependent on what happens in individual departments. The appointments teams in departments are really good. I mean, we have very close relationships. My team has very close relationships with the appointments teams. They're working very hard to make the system work. And I'm very impressed by their desire to have what we regard as an acceptable system. I talk a lot to permanent secretaries on this, that they want to have a system which is regarded as acceptable and so on. When problems come up, I'll talk to a permanent secretary and say, oh, let's talk about it, let's see if we work our way around it and do it. But ultimately, sometimes you've got to push back, you're right. He does. I mean, I believe that, and following what David Normington said, and he turned to be absolutely right on it, sometimes you've got to do it publicly. But 90% of it is done informally, prior warnings. I mean, what will happen on some things? For example, I mentioned the senior independent panel members. One Secretary of State wanted to appoint a Tory peer, which is directly against the code. So we basically said, to oversimplify, come off it. This is absolutely clear cut. And so that was done. Other cases, it's more oblique, but you find without embarrassing people, you can do it cheat a lot, but some cases you've got to do it publicly.
Well, sooner you than me. let's call Alan in. I can see we've got a few questions. Let me encourage people to keep sending your questions in. I know we've got some very distinguished people in the audience, and I hope that some of them have submitted questions. We've got half an hour or so, so we should be able to fit in quite a few. Alan, who would you like to call?
Thanks very much, Meg. We've had a good number of questions so far. I think there is still space for more. So as Meg said, do please come in if you'd like still to ask a question. I should say that gender diversity in appointments is making more progress than gender diversity in the questions that we're getting so far. So we have an all-male lineup as yet, but perhaps we can make progress on that as well. So given that we've had quite a few, I'll group questions in threes, if that's okay. And I suggest we start off with three people, Paul Evans, whose question I will ask myself, and then Jeremy Ross, and then Richard Thomas. So Paul Evans, whom many in the meeting will know as a former senior clerk in Parliament, asks, do parliamentary pre-appointment hearings discourage good candidates? Do they have a purpose? Should the range of posts subject to them be broadened? So that's Paul's question. And then, Jeremy says, Peter, I can understand your views on applicants' political views and activity. Can you comment on the extent of applicants' donations to the governing political party?
Yep.
And then the third question in this round is from Richard Thomas.
Peter, I think you justify what I might call excessive ministerial influence in the case of executive bodies and distinguish those from advisory bodies. But often executive bodies have statutory functions, and these statutory functions may not always align with government preferences. And I'm thinking particularly of regulatory bodies, which often cut across both executive and advisory roles. So I'm not yet convinced that your distinctions quite add up.
Richard, I understand exactly your point there. In a sense, it's a beginning of a debate on that distinction. I absolutely accept, which is why one of the points I made in relation to some bodies do have executive roles as well as regulatory roles. And I recognise that absolutely. And with statute does offer some protection in that respect. At present, everything is put in the same boat. I mean, you've got, well, I suppose you given judges have been taken out and that's treated in a different way. But in general, everything is technically viewed in exactly the same way. What I'm arguing for, which goes back actually to an Institute for Government report of 10 years ago, Read Before Burning, is more distinction brought in it. And I recognise that it's not as simple as saying regulatory versus executive, which is why it's very tentative in confining my initial suggestions to the constitutional political watchdogs rather than getting into broader regulatory terms. Because I do think, I accept your point absolutely, Richard, there are complications there. But I do think that some bodies which are clearly implementing government policy, some of the NHS bodies, for example. I know there's a big reorganisation going on there, which I hope will simplify things, because it's such a mess at present between executive agencies and arm's length bodies in health. But there, I can absolutely understand the involvement of ministers. In other cases, it's very different. But I think you've got to start a debate there, and that's something if PACAC had enough time, they should look at as well as the unit. But I take your point on that. On the point on donations come with insignificant political activity, so they're already covered. Donation, I think, I can't remember what the figure is, it's 5,000 a year or something like that. But the donations come within that. So the definition of the 10% covers donations over that amount already. On Paul's question, there's been long debate about, do they deter people? My view is they shouldn't. If you're chairing a public body, and remember, pre-appointment hearings only cover chairs of bodies, not members and independent regulators, you should be prepared for robust public and media questioning. I regard part of my response, I've gone on Twitter, I've been quite active on social media, deliberately, because I believe that's part of my role to respond to public and media questions. I'm not always satisfying people, frequently not, but you should do it. And similarly, I've taken very seriously not just my original pre-appointment hearing 5 years ago, but my relationship with PACAC. I mean, I wrote some recently about my extension. They published the correspondence with me and Michael Gove. It's up on their website today, on me being extended and so on. And I regard that as a very important part of my role. So I defend pre-appointment hearings because I think they're a central part of accountability for people holding public appointments. And sometimes they can go a bit haywire with people pursuing either arguments with ministers. There was a famous case of an argument between, I think it's Barry Shearman and Ed Balls, going back a long time now, 11, 12 years. They can get into that, and sometimes members of committees, which you and I both know, can not focus on what the pre-appointment hearing should do. But on the whole, I think they work pretty well in that way. In relation to definition, I think you have to have drawn it up beforehand. I disagree with what the units sometimes said on this. I think it's got to be clarity about what the roles are, so that candidates do know and are prepared for it and debated. And I think that obviously the intensity of it will vary depending on the individual and the nature of the post.
Terrific. Thank you very much. Whilst that's been going on, I've had a quick scroll through the questions, and there's some really strong ones in there. So I'm sure Alan's got some good stuff for us. But I can also verify that, with the possible exception of the ones marked anonymous, they are all from men. So we would like more diverse questioners, but we can only work with the material we've got. Alan, who would you like to invite next?
I can manage a round of questions that are, broadly speaking, about diversity. Firstly, a question from John Bryant, which I will read out, and then questions from Robert Moreland and Dermot Feenan. So John Bryant's question is, it appears the vast majority of appointments are made after interviews. What other assessment methods are used alongside traditional interviews to judge the quality of candidates? Test for competence for a role may be as important as discovering people know how to charm people in an interview setting. So that's John's question. And then Robert Moreland.
First of all, you probably think I'm something of a sinner because I was a Conservative member of the European Parliament. I think I've had appointments because I'm a Conservative, and I've not had appointments because I'm a Conservative. But I have to say the one that I've just retired from today.
Robert may have dropped off the call there. That's a terrible shame. Well, I can put the question that he's put in the Q&A. Which was, can you comment on discrimination related to age, cronyism, and not because of party, not wanting anyone politically connected? And then Dermot Feenan's question.
So, Peter, my question is, does your office monitor socioeconomic background in competitions? If so, how? And if not, should this be done? And I should say that the question is asked partly with reference to Section 1 of the Equality Act 2010, which you will probably know hasn't been implemented in England, but has recently been implemented in Wales and by Holyrood. And the context is also with reference to a number of appointments to public bodies recently, which seem to involve appointment of individuals with public school backgrounds, which seem to be disproportionate to the number of people with public school backgrounds in the population generally, which is a matter of concern.
Thank you. Excellent questions.
Right. Peter. Very interesting. I mean, on the backwards on this, we rely on diversity monitoring forms for the data. This is attached to your application, but is separate from the application for a post. We rely on that, and there's a lengthy dialogue about the content of those diversity monitoring forms to get them as accurate as possible. And there have been issues of, these aren't compulsory. We'd like them to be compulsory, allowing people then to say they don't want to answer a particular question, and so on and so forth. We want to extend the data. It is not as detailed as you're implying. It certainly doesn't cover education. We do try to cover occupation. In Scotland, they do have more extensive data than we have. It's a battle between comprehensiveness and depth on that. And it's we don't have as much data as I would like on that. It's certainly, going to your underlying point, I'm absolutely committed to broadening the social background. And indeed, some of the initiatives, which one I haven't mentioned at all, is a mentoring and development initiative, which I've been very keen on. And in fact, it comes from experience in Northern Ireland. There's a wonderful initiative there called Boardroom Apprentice, which is backed also by the Northern Ireland government, and which I've been involved in. I've been over to Belfast and seen and so on, which does try to broaden the social range of people and has mentoring schemes and has resulted in people having public appointments in Northern Ireland. And there's been a bit of that take up in with some UK-wide bodies too. For example, the DBS, which checks criminal records and so on, which is actually a Liverpool, but also Northern Ireland based. It's a UK-wide competency. That's got two mentors on that, and that's a very good way of broadening social background on that, and I'm very, very keen to do that. Also, the ideas I mentioned on remote meetings, again, is something which I think will broaden social involvement. It'll make things less metropolitan and make it easier for people to have various responsibilities to apply. So I'm extremely keen on that, and to broaden out from conventional groups. Also, NHS Improvement, which has been merged with NHS England, has some very good development schemes, both ethnically, but also we shouldn't take away social from that at all. I don't know about this public school point and all that at all, but certainly there is a greater drive to broaden social background. And that's obviously correlated with some of the other initiatives there. On age, the system is traditionally regarded as biased in favour of people of retirement age because of the point I made on income. And because most public appointments, half of them aren't paid at all, and a lot of them aren't paid in logically in relation to the time commitment, which is often much more than is advertised, that it's favoured on the whole people near retirement age or in retirement age. So that if anything, there's a push, and we made progress on getting younger people appointed. There are now many more people, I'm going to say younger, I mean from 55 young below that, and that's been progress has been made there, and that's good. On political activities, it can work every possible way on that. As I say, the interesting thing is how few people, I don't think there's discrimination against people with political activities. As I said in my remarks, it's neither a qualification nor a barrier. And indeed, many people with political activities are excellent public appointees because they understand all the pressures of operating the public sector. The point on interviews is a very interesting one. I sometimes regard the process for public appointment I'm involved with a big charity. No outside organization, let alone a big business organization or charity, would have such perfunctory formal processes as sometimes happens in the public sector. However, I am pleased to say for some posts, a broader range of is applying media tests if it's a very high profile position and so on. But I agree that in many cases it is too interview based. However, interviews aren't what they were. We're trying to get more diverse panels. That certainly already applies on gender, but it isn't nearly as diverse as it should be ethnically or disabled, and to make the process less forbidding and less, as you say, open to charm in that way. And that's why also in the applications, it's less tick box and it's more life experience. And so people, and there is a real desire to try and broaden out from the conventional people in that. But an interview-based one does have pluses and minuses, absolutely, on that.
That was a really interesting point. And I think, how far does that fall within your remit? I mean, I assume not that you would be purely advisory. You wouldn't be doing any research on those kind of processes or specifically making recommendations.
Meg, I'll take that as a recommendation. We double the size of my two.
Well, yes, it is very small.
Given that they're both I know online, they will, I'm sure, appreciate that. No, you're right. We're advisory on that, and yeah. I haven't gone in. I mean, it's something actually I rather regret because of all the other pressures. We haven't gone into more, and it could do, I mean, we decided to do remuneration because that was something you could quantify. I think there is something to be done on the techniques, and I if I had my time again, I'd have done something on that, and we should look at it. I mean, a related thing is use of headhunters.
I guess it raises the point, doesn't it, that who else is there aside from you who has a strategic overview of these things?
The cabinet office itself.
Yeah.
The cabinet office is a unit, a very good public appointments unit, whom obviously we talk to a lot. They coordinate the process and they run it. But of course, it's very departmentally run. I mean, I appreciate it as you say, I've written various books on politics. The baronies, you do learn about the baronies and the different characters of Whitehall departments. And they like to do their own thing. I mean, I'm forever urging that they cooperate and more, learn more, particularly departments which don't make many appointments can learn from those departments which do make appointments.
Yes.
And one of the interesting things is that some very powerful departments don't make very many public appointments. I mean, Foreign Development Office doesn't, MOD doesn't, Treasury. Well, Treasury is always on its own, but they could.
I think I remember you speaking to us before, and it was DCMS that had an astonishingly large number. Yeah.
DCMS makes an awful lot of appointments, does it very professionally. They are very experienced, and it's a big deal for DCMS. BEOS, business ones, Justice. The biggest one is Justice because all the local justice bodies, unlike the independent monitoring boards, parole boards, and health.
Alan's going to start glowering at us because he's now trying to juggle all that, because I can see more questions are coming in and I know there's some good ones left. So I should shut up and pass over to Alan.
Okay, thank you. Three questions that all I'm going to read out them all, I'm afraid, because that's what I've been asked to do. So two questions about your own position. One is from an anonymous attendee who says, am I able to ask what process is involved in appointing your replacement?
Fine.
Is it subject to a similar process as those which you have described? And somewhat related to that is a question from Robert Hazel, the aforementioned former director of the Constitution Unit, who says, your office rests on an order in council. What are the pros and cons of that? Would you prefer the office to have a statutory foundation? And then picking up on what you were saying a little earlier, Peter, Gabby asks, you said ministers should not leave candidates on their own. Do you mean to say that some candidates have been left accountable for their own appointment rather than ministers? Is there a role for Parliament to take the heat off candidates and onto ministers within the pre-appointment hearing system?
Right, three very good ones there. On the process, very straightforward. Yes, the process for appointing my successor is identical to a normal process. There was an advert last autumn. It's on the Cabinet Office website. To go back to mentioning the Cabinet Office coordinates those things. Its website lists the job, personal specification, who's on the interview panel and so on. All that occurred, all published. They had the courtesy to show me the job spec and ask for my comments and so on and so forth. And it was, I was perfectly happy with that. And I also made an appearance before the Public Administration Committee to discuss that process. And then there was an advert, there were interviews and so on. And that's where the process is now. The ministers are considering what the advisory interview panel did. Then once they've recommended a preferred candidate, and the word is preferred candidate, there'll be a pre-appointment hearing, just as I had 5 years ago. And so it's a normal process in that respect, absolutely. On Robert's question, the advantage of statutory backing, sorry, I should qualify, backing in primary legislation rather than statutory, because orders in council still have a legal effect, of course, is that it's harder to amend. And indeed, if you look at some of the debates of the last 10 years over the appointment of permanent secretaries, the existence of the CRAG Act has allowed, and indeed David Normanton said this recently in evidence of the Committee on Standards of Public Life, has provided a kind of firm framework for their debate over the over appointments of permanent secretaries. That in theory, an order in council could just be amended. There was a Privy Council meeting last night. You just put it up, there's no publicity, no attention. I, under the order in council, have to be consulted on any changes. But it's much more flexible, and your in theory things can change. And that's, but when one talks about primary legislation, that is only a backing, because the codes, for example, the civil service code, is produced as a code and can be changed. And for example, the governance code, I don't think anyone envisages that being written down in statute. It'd be far too inflexible. But it does provide a kind of firmness of backing for the appointment of people like me, if you had it in primary legislation. And that I would favour, but the distinction between that and the code in practice. On the point, why don't we make ministers more accountable? What happens at present is a preferred candidate is announced. There's a press release which saying, the minister saying, this is the most wonderful person has ever been to do this job. And then they appear before the committee. And but very seldom is there anything more than that, that the Secretary of State kind of stands back from the process. And I think sometimes when it's a particularly controversial, not all the time at all, and this is very much my own view, partly because it happened in my case, because my nomination got tied up with a row over Grimstone, that the government decided to publish the results of the Grimstone review on the same day they announced I was a preferred candidate. The Public Administration Committee was a bit irked by that, and I became the spokesman almost for Grimstone, which is a pretty odd position to be in, and that wasn't entirely satisfactory. So they had a second hearing with Jerry Grimstone, which is very good. They had Matt Hancock, who was then the Minister of Public Appointments, before he rose to his current eminence, and also David Norrington, my predecessor, and it was a fairly grueling session, but it was good. I thought it was good because it enabled a proper discussion about the powers and role to come through. And sometimes I think getting a Secretary of State there to explain why they picked someone. The problem is, quite rightly, under confidentiality, you don't disclose who the runners-up are. Some select committees would like to know who the other candidates are. I think it's very important that this process remain confidential, because otherwise you discourage candidates coming forward. But I do think what I'm saying on that is, at present, there's a tendency that a candidate is all up to you, not up to the person who's nominating them.
Alan, do you want to bring some more people in?
I certainly will. Yep. So I'd like to ask John Cartledge to ask his question. And before that, I will ask read out two questions from others. So one is from an anonymous attendee who asks, what is your view on a minister pressing ahead to appoint a preferred candidate deemed appointable by an independent panel at interview stage, but then unanimously rejected by a select committee at pre-appointment scrutiny hearing? How can that decision be justified? And then we also have a question from Zach Puller, who's a volunteer here at the Constitution Unit, who asks, could you elaborate further on your comments about the difference between those constitutional watchdogs with a parliamentary link and those without, and the implications of this distinction for the rigour of appointments to these watchdogs?
So I'll do these two. Yeah, the first one is actually on... In fact, it goes back to the Charity Commission appointment of Baroness Stoll a few years ago, when exactly that happened, when she was very strongly, and we know this because one of the panel talked about it subsequently, nothing to do with me, strongly backed by an interview panel and was a recommended candidate. And then the DCIS committee rejected her. And Matt Hancock, whose name keeps popping up, he was then the Secretary of State at DCMS, which then had responsibility, well, has responsibility for the Charity Commission, and immediately appointed her. And in fact, on the same day as the committee produced its hostile critical report, that provoked the liaison committee to have its inquiry into pre-appointment hearings. It provoked the Public Administration Committee, at the request of the Liaison Committee, to have its inquiry and to produce recommendations, most of which, well, the substance of which, wasn't accepted by the government. Now, on this, I think my and this is what I said in evidence to PACAC myself, there should be a cooling off period. What should happen is, if a select committee, which after all, by definition, has a government majority on it, disagrees with the recommended candidate, it shouldn't immediately rush into print, but should contact the Secretary of State to have a discussion with the Secretary of State about saying, we have reservations about this candidate. Can these be resolved? And often I think that would be the desirable thing, to have this, not a long cooling off period, perhaps a week, 10 days, something like that. And then the issue is, if there is then a disagreement, should it go on the floor of the House? And that, I think, which is the point that I know, in fact, Robert Hazell made and the unit made at the time. And I think that's where, how far is the ultimate decision to a ministerial one as opposed to a parliamentary one? And that's the difficult issue. My own thing is that instead of rushing into overruling a select committee, there should be a cooling off period, and that should be part of the process. Some of that is in effect accepted on it, but I certainly think it wasn't a good look when there was an immediate overruling of the select committee. Now, maybe they would have continued to disagree, and they might well have done so, but I think there has to be that cooling off period. On the distinctions of various watchdogs and the parliamentary ones and so on, some of them have just grown up in the way they have. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily go back from starting saying X should report to Parliament. The Electoral Commission was set up in a way that Parliament had the say-so and indeed has a say on its supervising and so on, even though it also reports to PACAC and so on. It's got a divided accountability in a way. But the budgetary and other accountabilities to Parliament, and you could say that's because it's to do with election of MPs and others, and that's the correct process. It's not entirely clear. I mean, most of the ones I described earlier, myself, Civil Service Commission, HOLAC on House of Lords, visit appointments and so on are to do with ministerial decisions, and that's where the distinction comes in. However, I still think there has to be demonstrably independent in both the people who occupy the posts like mine and in the process of appointment. And I think also to have a parliamentary role. I mean, the Office of Budget Responsibility is a classic. That was basically Andrew Tyree. At the time when it was set up in 2010, he pressed successfully with a number of government MPs at the time for this process where effectively the Treasury Committee has a veto. And that, I mean, governments resisted this as a precedent and basically haven't followed it. But I think that's an interesting one to explore. I don't think there are hard and fast rules. I just think there's some very interesting issues which need to be further explored. And going back to Richard Thomas's very good question on, you know, hybrid bodies, which have both regulatory and executive responsibilities, I would like more of a debate on how you draw that and how you ensure there is more independence on it. I don't think there are clear-cut solutions by any means.
Now, we must end soon. We promised to end by 2:15, but poor John Cartledge was encouraged to ask his own question in the last round, and we cut across him. So let's have John Cartledge. And if Lisa James still wants to ask her question, in the interests of gender balance and, of course, total favouritism, because she's my super clever researcher, I think we should ask Lisa James to ask her question as well, and then let's end. So, John.
Good afternoon, Peter. Good to see you. I remember you well from our student days.
Indeed, Rod. Indeed.
That doesn't disqualify me from asking the question. I suspect that there are plenty of examples of other countries which handle this process worse. But I wondered whether you'd come across good practice anywhere else in the world which you think that we could usefully emulate here.
Hold that for a minute. I don't know whether Lisa still wants to ask her question or whether Lisa has disappeared. Ask your question.
Thank you, Meg. And in the interest of honesty, I should fess up that I am a former headhunter who worked on public appointments. So this has been really fascinating. Thank you, Peter. This goes back to something that you've already touched on. I was wondering what your views are on whether there is anything that should be done to improve the clarity of the process, particularly with a view to diversity. Part of my experience working on public appointments was often that people who weren't fairly familiar with the public sector were quite mystified by the amount of jargon and some of the more uncharacteristic bits of the process that can go on around these appointments, particularly with regard to things like the role of ministers and where and how that fits in. Do you think there's anything that should be done to make that clearer or more understandable in the interest of making these accessible to a wider range of people?
Great, thank you. And going back to what we said before, but these might be things for you to refer to the Cabinet Office, but give us your view.
on the clarity of the process, yes, it can be. I mean, one of the things I find, it's been obviously been frustrating for the last 15 months, but one of the things I tried to do is talk to as many groups as possible about explaining the process. I did something, actually it was a Zoom thing with Women on Boards. I did something with the Pakistani community in Britain on public appointments. And I found actually quite a lot of it was doing a kind of educational role, explaining what it was. You're quite right about the jargon. It can be appalling. Anything where you approach the Ministry of Defence or anything like that, beware of jargon. Indeed, sometimes I've had to, my team and I have tried to work out what a public body does. It's not always clear from the jargon. One of the team suggested going back to the Greek origins of the word to work out what one particular body did. He was right in that respect. But no, there is a problem of clarity. And I find explain to people the process, the role of ministers and so on. And I think that's very important. It also goes back to the good question asked about social background and so on. That it's a deterrent. People think these are remote bodies. Well, you know, I say there are a lot of technical bodies and so on and so forth, where it's a certain number of scientists or whatever. But a lot of them aren't. They're bodies delivering services to all of us who are on this webinar. And therefore, you do want a broad thing and you want to simplify the process and make it more accessible. And that's where mentoring and development schemes are really helpful. And I'm a passionate believer in that. And now we've got a pilot with the Public Chairs Forum, which is the kind of trade body for chairs of public bodies, the Cabinet Office and my office. And my senior policy advisor is very actively doing that. And that I hope will bring forward a wider range of people who aren't put off by it. Now, John's question on experience overseas, I can't really give you a satisfactory answer on that because I haven't really looked very much. I mean, all I can say is I've looked at the Scotland and Northern Ireland have very distinct systems of public appointments. They're their own regulators. We compare notes once a year, and they're very different. And they're evolving in very different way. I mean, Northern Ireland has particular problems with sectarianism, but Scotland has some problems with the nature of the political setup there. And whilst it's further in advance on some things than we are UK-wide, on others it's facing a number of difficulties. So it's always a tension in a lot of systems between patronage and competition. The other big difference I'd say is in a lot of countries is in devolution. That if you're looking at Germany or the US, a lot of the equivalent bodies to here are political bodies, political appointees made by either state governments in the US, and their political patronage is a patronage system often rather than competition, or by local elected political bodies. So we're more unusual in having such a centralized structure in that way. On that, one of the things I have found is I've learned a lot from, and this is something, I mean, it goes back to something the Constitution has been really involved in. I've learned a lot from the devolved administrations, devolved bodies. I that started when I was in the Institute for Government, but certainly my current experience working, say, with the Welsh Government has been really interesting, and seeing a very different culture there and different operations. And some of the challenges there are different from UK-wide ones. And it's been, even though they operate the same code, some of the actual practical challenges are very different. And also they've come up with some interesting innovations in some ways on diversity and on the way they run competitions.
Thank you so much, Peter. We're now up against time. So I think it's just for me to say thank you so much for joining us today, for your opening remarks, for your very open attitude to the questions. Always a pleasure to host you. Thank you to Alan for marshalling the questions. Thank you to all of the people who submitted such excellent questions, and apologies to anyone who didn't get in. Thank you to everybody else for attending, and do please look out for the video and the audio, which will be available on our podcast of this event afterwards, and point people towards them if you felt it was an interesting event. And then, of course, look out for our next event, which, as I said, will be on ministerial standards, quite a topical issue. We'll be publicising that soon. It will be taking place in May. And if you want to make sure that you hear about all of our events as soon as they are made public, then do please make sure that you join the mailing list for the Constitution Unit, which you can find on our website, and click to hear about our events. So thank you, everybody, and I look forward to seeing many of you at a future event.
Thank you, Meg. Thanks very much indeed. Thank you, Alan.